Hello and welcome to Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons. This week, I meet the world's greatest dad. Not that he admits it, but Robin Williams does join me, along with his director Bobcat Goldthwaite, to talk growing pains and parenthood in their new film, World's Greatest Dad. And we venture to the front line of Middle East politics. Ronit Avni is the producer of Budrus, a documentary about the tiny Palestinian town that saw off the Israeli army through peaceful protest. Zan Brooks joins me to look at Ben Affleck and Rebecca Hall in The Town, and Julia Roberts rethinking everything in Eat, Pray, Love. Yes, it's Download, Listen, Love. It's Film Weekly. After a second spell in rehab and a heart operation, Robin Williams felt like a new man. So he got one. It came in the form of his old stand-up friend Bobcat Goldthwaite, now an increasingly successful writer-director, about to break through with the best work either artist has done in ages, World's Greatest Dad. In the film, Williams plays Lance, an amiable, if loserish, failed novelist and high school teacher, whose son Kyle attends the same school and is disliked by almost everyone. Indeed, Kyle's one of the most unattractive teenagers I've ever seen on screen. A bully to his best friend, rude to his father, and addicted to internet porn, an obsession that eventually leads to his sad demise.
What you're doing is dangerous.
What, beating your arm?
No, not that. We all have needs, Kyle.
Needs? What are you talking about?
Masturbation is natural.
Oh, you know it's not natural.
What?
Talking about jerking off with your dad. That's not natural.
Don't
shit.
Do that, please, okay?
Why?
Because your feet are dirty. Because I said so.
Well, let me out here.
Let me park in the lot.
Lance, I'm going to look like a dillweed walking in with you, all right? It's bad for my rep.
Don't call me Lance.
It's your name, isn't it?
However, in this blackest of comedies, Kyle's misfortune becomes his father's making, as Lance fakes his son's journal, only to watch it become a publishing sensation. The film is, of course, a satire on America's sentimentality and grief industry, but it's also a brutally honest look at parenting, one made all the more acerbic given Williams' previous screen incarnations in inspirational educator roles such as Dead Poets Society and Good Will Hunting. I met up with Bobcat Goldthwaite and Robin Williams, determined to keep Williams under as much control as possible while discussing parenting, a new lease of life, and the meaning of dark. Bobcat Goldthwaite, Robin Williams, welcome to Film Weekly. Hello to see you.
Hello, Mr. Goldthwaite.
It's a pleasure to meet you.
We elect to receive. Thank you, sir.
Congratulations on your new film, World's Greatest Dad. Are you the world's greatest dad, Robin?
No, I'm I'm a work in progress, Dad. I think Dad 2.0. Yeah. I'm really, I'm blessed to have amazing children who've tolerated me all this long. So I think, that title doesn't fit me. No. Dad would be all right.
Yeah. You get lucky if they just call you that.
Call you Dad. When my son, when he was three, said, Robin, when did you become a little executive? Robin, Zelda and I have come up with an idea for a new plan. It was and years ago I was reading a story to Zelda and I was doing voices and she went, Robin, just read the story. I don't need the voices. I went, thank you, you're three, Zelda. Thank you so much. That cuts to the chase. Yeah. Just stick with the story. Yeah. Okay, got it.
You need direction in life sometimes.
As we do, yes, especially from your children. So it's a bit like magic, misdirection. Look over here, look over here, look over here. Oh, good luck, thank you.
What was Bobcat Goldthwaite like giving direction? Well, I'm going to go to you, Bobcat. What was it like giving Robin Williams direction? Because even the three-year-old Zelda has trouble containing him. So how did you manage?
Well, misdirection is my drag name. I I think giving Robin
racial
direction.
Racial tensions is mine.
It was funny. It was like he was very, very receptive. But we are friends, so now during dinner I want to say, that was good, just do it, you have to go louder on this take. No, so we're best friends, so it worked really well.
And you're still best friends?
Yeah, oh. That's what I'm saying. So, normally I don't know, there was a lot of collaboration in this movie.
He gave me one of the best directions. There's a scene where I'm on two things he said. There's a scene where as I'm on a talk show for the first time, and he said, number one, you've never been on a talk show. I went, oh, yeah, right, okay. Remember that part, so it's not like you do this all the time. And number two, he said, sell the big lie, which is that your kid was a really wonderful, sensitive boy. And in the process of selling the lie, that everything kind of fell apart, and that was wonderful because it just freed me up to go, the more you're trying to keep that the fantasy going, the more he's going, this is all a ruse, I'm a sham. And everything kind of broke down, and I told him, I said, I think I just had the closest thing to a nervous breakdown on a film, in a film set that I've ever had. And he went, great, can you do it again?
Yeah. And it was that, like, was really good. That was really good. You need to just do it again. Yeah. We're coming in tighter now.
Yeah.
It's a lovely, I say a lovely movie. It's not, it's a horribly dark kind of movie in the best kind of twisted fashion, which I really enjoy.
But yeah, I will say this, normally when folks describe a movie as dark, it's very nihilistic, and at the end, in the last couple of movies that I got to make, that people consider them dark, but I don't because, in the middle of all the awkwardness and mire, it's actually kind of hopeful in a really weird way.
But I think we have to kind of qualify it with the dark, because otherwise people definitely go to comedy and they kind of think, oh, it's going to be hilarious, it's going to be funny, it's going to be running around, which it is, all of those things, but there is a sort of underbelly of thought to it. So dark comedy is it's a kind of compliment. I agree, it's a kind of lazy shorthand and I shouldn't have done it. Will you smack me, please?
No. Yeah, will you smack me?
And
slowly.
I think it is an easy
thing to do, because you look to try and identify things, because initially with a title like this, you're going, oh, it's a crazy, zany comedy.
And it's really hard to promote because World's Greatest Dad, people do think it's a wacky movie. And then the fact that, the word dark is hard to
initially
use
was called
too.
Dead Penis Society. And then people go like, no, you can't use that. Too late.
And I understand. I know I sounded weird when I got off on this tangent of how dare you call it dark. Pshaw. It's just that I think the movies that I've been making were comedies for adults instead of like American comedies. Are rated R often, or adult comedy, and then they're hoping that 12-year-olds discover it.
Yeah.
And this is a comedy that was made for adults, hoping that adults find it.
It's kind of refreshing in the Apatow world, which is whose world we now live in, the funny people world. These are kind of smart comedies. They're quite vulgar. Your film is not vulgar in that way, although it has all of the kind, it has masturbation and it has all of that stuff, which is healthy.
I think you need for a good afternoon. Well Hung Boy is the name of the movie, actually. But the kid is like, he's got this really funky, nasty, his interests are very, I would say, towards the pornographic. Mm. But the father is not like, the kid's almost smarmy in the terms of the things. And even his own friend is like going, do you want to watch Scheisse porn? No, not really. Like.
I mean, you've dealt with a lot of kids, Dead Poets,
this is kind of the exact opposite of Dead Poets. In Dead Poets, you have an inspirational teacher. This is a guy who is lucky to have two kids take his class, his poetry optional class. And at one point they say, no one likes your poetry class. There's not many kids take it. He goes, well, sir, no one likes poetry, really.
Yeah. Was that the attraction to kind of play opposite to Captain My Captain?
No, the attraction was to play a character this kind of complex and awkward with a really interesting, group of other characters.
Who gets naked at the end?
Yeah, that was my idea. And I like to do that at the end of every movie. They just don't use it.
Yeah.
But it was the
Thank
idea.
God Mrs. Doubtfire they didn't.
Oh, God, that'd be frightening. Oh, God. It was frightening enough to see me half in makeup, half out with my hairy arms and her makeup. It was like a bad prison movie. Oh, dear, don't be afraid of the leg warmers on my arm. But it was like, no, I went, if the character's going to be shedding everything, why not, just say, he just has that thing of, okay, it's another way, another almost breakdown of like, that's it, I'm losing everything. Mm. And it's kind of like, and he went, sure.
Now, I'm sure you mentioned your children who are very strong-minded and have clear direction of where they're going and where they want you to go. What if you came back and discovered them kind of indulging in the dark side of childhood and moving towards the pornographic? What would you that would not
anyone who has a child going, what are the long showers about? It was the catch and release program. I think they've already been through that, and now one's married, and Zelda has a boyfriend, lives in LA, and Cody has a girlfriend. So I think it's a bit like too late for catching him in that. And they were kind of it's very difficult. I didn't monitor all their internet use, but I know that. But in a weird way, I went, they'll know on their own. I mean, and they
never had those awkward dad conversations, because you play them very beautifully in this film.
Yeah, this thing of, no, I haven't had those. The ones of like, so do you want, no, Dad, do you know about felching? What? No, I didn't, Cody, what's that? And snowballing? What? No, I didn't know about that. What is that? Ow, no. I don't know why all of a sudden I become Chris Walken. No, don't tell me, no. They've done all these things kind of I didn't have all those awkward conversations, for better or worse. Mm-hmm. And they've turned out quite well on their own.
Good.
I've had that kind of conversation where it's been like, it's very difficult to go, you shouldn't do drugs. And they're going, and what happened to you? bad example. Let me. What about you and your relapse? Okay, another bad example. But what do you, you know, you deal with them and you hope that, you know, you say, don't do it. And in a weird way, me being that kind of out there has driven them the other way, yeah. of being more kind of on their own.
But you look very well, it has to
I
be said.
I feel very well. You know, new hearts work, you know, new valves, cow valve. I can shit while I walk. It's just very much, it's a nice thing of, you know, you get a second chance, me 2.0. It's really nice thing to have, really. So, and here's the greatest line. People always say laughter is the best medicine.
Oh, no, it's nitroglycerin is the best medicine, it turns out.
Laughter will not help you during a minor heart attack.
I mean, you're going to have the best joke, but that sweet, sweet nitro is really...
I think that's going to be a great
thing ever happened to me.
sweet nitro. What's up with that? That's going to be a new song.
I got nitro.
Like an old blues song. Like, yeah, my sweet nitro.
Or like,
oh, now get me down below, my sweet nitro.
What do you need? Do you have any nitro?
Nitro. Yeah, I need
I'm not into that. 50
I'm not CCs.
Into blow anymore.
Yeah, I'm off cocaine. What are you into? Lipitor nitro.
I look forward to the world's greatest pusher, the sequel.
Oh, yeah. Well, too late when this at this age. What are you doing? Everything. When every drug they sell has such horrible side effects. Tendency to grow another head. Rectal ventriloquism. Call now. Please, world's greatest pusher this fall.
It's great. Lovely to see you at your age. It's great to see you.
You're still alive.
Congratulations on that.
Thanks.
And on world's greatest dad. Cheers, guys. Robin Williams and Bobcat Goldthwait. The World's Greatest Dad is on release here in the UK from Friday, the 24th of September. In Boston, if we can't get it, we just go steal it. You know what I'm saying? Check it. Listen, I don't know what's real and what isn't. From The World's Greatest Dad to The World's Finest Film Critics, Zan Brooks joins me in the pod to review some of the week's other releases. Welcome, Zan.
Thanks.
We'll be looking at The Town, directed by and starring Ben Affleck and Rebecca Hall. You can tell me about Eat, Pray, Love, starring Julia Roberts. We'll talk about Enter the Void as well from French-Argentinian Gaspar Noé. But we'll start with The World's Greatest Dad, because we just heard Robin Williams there. This is a departure, as sort of I've noted for him, although Robin Williams himself never seems to notice, really, what world is in. I'm never sure if he knows if he's in a good film or a bad film.
I think you're right. And if anything, that was part of the interest and part of the flaws with World's Greatest Dad. On the one hand, it's very, very brave of him to do this, because he's basically taking the characters that he played in, say, Mrs. Doubtfire as a divorced dad and Dead Poets Society as a sort of would-be inspirational yeah. teacher and subverting them. And it's a very dark, scabrous, misanthropic comedy. And yet you're right. There's a sense that he's still doing the Robin Williams twinkle.
There's a bit,
and he just looks a little bit pained, doesn't
yeah.
he? It's almost like he thinks that he's still in Dead Poets Society, but suddenly everyone's swearing at him, and he's thinking, "Well, that's not very nice,
that's
is
not very
it?"
Nice. He's still got the same core joke. There's that. It's a little mouth thing he does. I was watching him close up, and it's like a little crumply kind of like,
yeah.
"Oh shucks," kind
a little
of little
kind
thing.
Of poignant smile.
Yeah. I was talking to the writer Alison Pearson the other day. He says dropping
like journalists,
but she was. Sort of said, well, she's married to Anthony Lane anyway, so she knows. She sort of says, well, every time I say go to a film, Anthony goes, no, don't see that. She says, what can I go and see? You know, would you be different? And I said, well, what about The World's Greatest Dad? Because, you know, she's always writing about women and
yeah.
the, you know, mums and stuff. I said, what about The World's Greatest Dad? She goes, oh, yeah, maybe I'll take the kids to it. I said, no, don't. Whatever you do, do not take your children to it. She went, but it's Robin Williams' film, The World's Greatest Dad. I think they've got a problem.
I think they're going to have a lot of outraged punters yeah. at this film.
Because
which is probably no bad thing.
No bad thing. I mean, it would be a really corrective. And I mean, but that Robin Williams thing does work, because he is still quite funny in it, because he's in it, not because he's being funny.
Yeah.
It's just sort of seeing him kind of have almost sort of trying to have sex with someone. I find that really weird.
You see a lot of him. You see him start bullet naked
you
at
do,
one stage.
Absolutely. I have to say, I mean, I've seen it twice, and I just relished its existence more
oh,
than
yeah.
kind of watching. I think it's a really interesting kind of piece of work. It's kind of a sort of a dangerous firework thrown into the multiplexes.
It is. It's a welcome addition and a good move by Robin Williams, even if there are slight problems with the role.
Let's move on to The Town, which is Ben Affleck's follow-up to Gone Baby Gone. I never thought you'd be sort of saying that, but about Ben Affleck, he's developing a sort of a career here, mainly sort of mired in the Boston Underground.
Yeah.
That first one was about disappeared kids, written by Dennis Lehane. This one, again, is a Boston crime drama. Ben Affleck stars himself as a robber, a sort of career bank robber, and he is doing quite well until he robs a bank where he actually falls in love with one of the victims, played by Rebecca Hall.
A few days ago, my bank was robbed. four men took it over and opened the safe. They took me as a hostage. They blindfolded me and drove me around. And then they stopped and let me out.
Sorry.
It's not your fault. The FBI guy told me it would feel like I was in mourning.
FBI? You're working with the FBI?
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean? The guy comes by, checks in on you, gives you a call, that kind of thing?
Pretty much.
They don't have any suspects, any clues, any leads, anything like that?
Not that they've told me. He intimated that they were scouring Charlestown, but they were wearing masks, so... I'm sure I'd recognize their voices if I heard them again.
Maybe harder than you think.
Rebecca Hall there in The Town. She's playing an American in this one. She's quite good at playing Americans, but a certain type of American.
Yeah, very much the blue blood preppy American. This is set rather well, I think, set in this neighborhood of Boston, Charlestown, which has apparently produced more bank robbers than any other city ever in the history of cities.
It says popular when you get in there. It says population 8,006. 8,004. It keeps going down.
Yeah, it's good. It shows it to be partly gentrified. So you've got like the yuppies moving in, but you've also got the old working class Irish or criminal class Irish in a lot of cases with their sort of cheap saloon bars and shamrock tattoos and all the tribal
the
loyalties.
The stuff we've seen in The Departed by Martin Scorsese. I mean, it is a genre in itself now.
I guess it is. And he makes a lot of it. And that aspect of the film I found probably the most interesting and compelling. The rest of it I had a bit of a problem with.
Yeah, you did. I mean, I think we mentioned this in Venice where it kind of made its international debut. It's actually done very well since then, was very well received in Toronto, has become number one at the US box office. Well, no, I think you know the right thing. The stuff that is good is quite good. The car chases, the actual sort of heist around Fenway Park, the bank robberies themselves, which have a bit of, they reminded me of the Point Break ones, didn't they? Where they wear kind of strange masks and jump over the sides and sort of say, everybody down.
Yeah, the action sequences are very, very well done. He knows what he's doing with a camera, Ben Affleck here.
Much interest in John Hamm from Mad Men being one of the feds in here.
Yeah.
I got a feeling. I mean, I always thought John Hamm was brilliant.
Oh,
Mad Men.
Superb.
I think he's great. But now, having seen him in the Venice press conference and in this film, and then read some interviews with him,
I've got a feeling
he's a bit boring.
Yeah, but isn't that often the way with actors? You know, it's the writers, darling, that give them their kudos and their mystique.
And I suppose because I didn't know him before Don Draper, so you think, well, I don't. And Don Draper.
Don Draper is just a great character, and he does it brilliantly well. This sells him a bit short, I think, because it's very much the obvious role of the thwarted federal agent who's always trying to catch the bad guys, but they're a bit too smart for him, and he has this sort of long-suffering frown and scowl on his face.
Why did he do it? Because Don Draper's always in charge, you know, and this guy's just always going, ooh, Affleck, you know, it's like,
Well, I guess the grass is always greener, isn't it? I mean, he's in TV, he's getting huge plaudits for and awards and Golden Globes and what have you for Mad Men, but, you know, Hollywood movie is quite a seductive thing. And so you go with that and then you get lumbered with a role that, you know, Ernest Borgnine would have been playing 30
playing
years ago.
Yeah, playing second fiddle to Ben Affleck.
Yeah, it's
never
not good.
A good idea, no. I don't think. Even if he's proving to be a decent-ish director. Although I think Jeremy Renner kind of looks tough enough to kind of...
Yeah, he does. He looks the part.
Yeah, I like that. So The Town, I think it's rubbish, but I quite enjoyed the rubbish.
I just think it's kind of bogus and meat-headed.
Yeah, it is. Well done. Talking of bogus, tell me about Eat, Pray, Love, which is a novel I have studiously avoided at every turn on every beat. For the last couple of years, someone gave it to my wife to read and said, you would like this. And I went, I read the cover of it and looked at it. I said, I really hope you don't like this. Otherwise, I may have to get a divorce.
And did she like
it? No, she didn't like
it.
So she did finish it, though.
She did, yeah.
I finish fish and chips sometimes, and I know it's not good for me.
It's not even quite a novel, is it? It's a sort of memoir.
Yeah.
By
someone I never heard of.
A privileged American writer who walks out of her marriage and goes to find herself. It's like that old 80s song that I've never been to me.
Been to Nice and the Isles of Greece, but never been to me. Yeah.
I've been undressed by kings and I've seen some things.
You certainly have.
I'm going to Italy.
Italy? Why Italy?
I used to have this appetite for food, for my life, and it is just gone. I want to go someplace where I can marvel at something. Language, gelato, spaghetti, something.
Ugh, you're talking like a college kid.
Well, you know, I've been acting like one. Since I was 15, I've either been with a guy or breaking up with a guy. I have not given myself 2 weeks of a breather to just deal with, you know, myself.
So it's basically that, but stretched over 2 hours. With Julia Roberts as the Elizabeth character who walks out of her marriage and goes to find herself and goes to Italy and Italy for the food, I think, India for the spirituality.
Well, no, probably to lose some weight with dysentery, having eaten some pasta
exactly.
and carbs in
exactly.
Italy.
It's karmic.
It'd be absolutely kind of terrible thing for an actress
and
to
then,
eat.
And then, yeah, barley for the love and, you know, maybe Bognor to get a...
Four seasons.
Yeah, so Bognor to get her ears syringed, I think.
So they eat. That's the eating, that's the praying, that's the love. That's what she does. She eats.
She does, yeah, she eats.
So is there
prays,
a vomit bit? Because she
loves.
Or is it us?
I was hoping
vomits?
It could be eat, pray, love, die.
Zan, we have also looked at Enter the Void this week, which I think is a very nice companion piece to Eat, Pray, Love. It's Gaspar.
Imagine just taking the wrong turn in a cinema and ending up in Enter the Void.
This is Gaspar Noé, the man who's brought us Seul contre tous and Irreversible, two of the hardest films you're ever likely to see. Is Enter the Void in that same realm
of
really, hardness?
It really is. It really is. And yet I thought it was kind of extraordinary, this film.
But it's a trip, isn't it? I mean,
it's a real trip. It sound kind of annoying. And I guess it is. I mean, in a way, it's very self-indulgent.
Yeah.
It's basically about an American dope dealer in Tokyo who gets shot very early on by the cops in this sort of seedy bar called The Void.
Do you take drugs?
Drugs?
Yeah, do you take drugs?
No.
Never once have you taken drugs?
Never once.
Never once?
Never once. But I like alcohol.
Yeah, so you like alcohol and then you like drugs. It's like one step, then the next step.
One step. Yeah.
And then it flashes back, I guess. His spirit leaves his body and floats out across the Tokyo streets and drifts back and forth and then drifts back into the past. And we see his relationship with his sister, Linda, who's played by Paz de la Huerta. And these two kids have been orphaned in a car crash. And they've got a kind of sort of budding, almost incestuous relationship. And they're clinging to each other and almost trying to get back to this idealized sort of pre-sexual state of childhood.
So that there's something of Irreversible in that.
Yeah.
Kind of time ruins everything, that there is a kind of idyll somewhere, but it's been ruined by time and by people themselves.
Yeah, but it's kind of superb in what it's doing.
Like technically
it's astonishing.
Director.
It kind of it conjures Tokyo into this vast exploded set where it goes through walls and over busy streets and then through windows, and we eavesdrop on various scenes and conversations, and it's a bit like sort of dialing across a sort of long-wave radio station that you're kind of in and out of the action. And it is totally captivating. It's also, I mean, you know, it has to be said, it's gonna freak out a lot of people. There's an abortion scene in here. There's you know, drug use. And it ends with this sort of 10-minute sex sequence of just all these people kind of screwing in a hotel.
Yeah.
That then ends with a penis ejaculating. So, you know, if you think you're going to go and see Eat, Pray, Love and you wind up in this, your brain is going to melt.
Especially if you've taken the teenagers to see World's Greatest Dad
in
the first place.
I know.
And you were just looking for something else.
You'd be in a padded cell writing home with crayons.
So Film Weekly warning you about Watch the Week.
This is a public
in a way, Ben Affleck's sentimental crime drama about Boston is the safest film this week.
It is.
Zan, lovely to see you again. Zan Brooks there. For a comprehensive list of reviews and the best in film news, just go to guardian.co.uk/film. Also on the site, you will find out about the Guardian and Observer's film season 2010. What, you ask, is this film season? Well, joining me to tell me more is Guardian film editor Andrew Pulver. Welcome back, Andrew. Nice to see you. Tomorrow, Friday's film and music, the massive section, the one we all look forward to every Friday, there's going to be published a Power 100 in there. First of all, kicking off our film season.
Absolutely.
And now
will be the first
thing. What power are we talking about? What is power in film terms?
It is a very difficult thing to define. What we were trying to do was try and work out who influences what we, the British film goer, sees. So what this list will be on tomorrow in film music isn't a British film industry power list in the sense of who gets films made or who earns the most money. It is really about who influences our cultural map, if you like. Obviously, at one end, there are massive Hollywood players like Christopher Nolan, Steven Spielberg, but also at the other end, we've got the sort of small art house distributors, people who run little programs of artist films. So the idea was trying to map out who influences what we see.
In compiling this list of the Power 100, you presumably didn't sit in a room yourself and kind of go, well, you know, he should be at number 50 and that one at number one. Did you throw yourself open to the mercy of the British film industry? Or
absolutely. I mean, it is staggering as a journalist when you sort of sit down and really try and work something like this out. You realise how ignorant you are, really, of the sort of wider commercial concerns of the film industry.
So who did you go to, just
so
as an example?
On our panel, advisory panel, we had, for example, the film producer Colin Vaines, who is just doing Madonna's film at the moment. He's a very nice guy. He used to be a journalist for Screen International.
And then Harvey Weinstein picked him up, made him Miramax.
Absolutely. With talking of Screen International, we also had the editor of Screen International, it's called Mike Goodrich. He was on the panel. We had hotshot PR woman Kate Lee, who I'm sure you know well, Jason. We also had, representing the sort of art house end of things, Kate Garova, who is head of acquisitions for Soda Films, who do lots of sort of foreign language films.
They just picked up Tran Anh Hung's Norwegian Wood from Venice, I'm pleased to say.
Hot news there. They also had Skeletons, which was that the film that won Edinburgh.
Absolutely. Well, they've started the new British Film Quarterly initiative, which I wholeheartedly support, and has given some great exposure to things like 1, 2, 3, 4 and Skeletons.
Totally. And we also had Hannah McGill, who has just left Edinburgh International Film Festival as the director.
When I open up Film Music on Friday and look at the influences of British film goers' tastes or options, really, as well, because some of those, you know, we can only go and see what is available sometimes. How much in the pocket of distant power maker brokers are we? How much influence does Hollywood, for example, exert on us?
I think it's unavoidable that you will find major Hollywood players at or near the top of this list. I mean, it's just a fact of life, brutal fact of life, that that they dominate what goes on. I think what we've tried to do in our power list is to weight it towards the people who we think enthuse the Guardian readership as an audience. So I can't name actual positions, but people like Christopher Nolan, like Spielberg, like James Cameron are the people who, although they are big Hollywood names, are people that with us and our readers are interested in. We had massive arguments in with the panel over Michael Bay, who is obviously a huge money director, but we felt he's just not somebody of interest to Guardian readers.
And if they have 12-year-old children downwards and have to buy Christmas presents.
Yeah, so he basically didn't make it.
He's gonna nuke your ass.
Yeah, he's gonna send those bloody robots over here, isn't he?
Andrew Pulver, I look forward to reading the order of that Power 100 on Friday in Film and Music, and to the rest of the film season on the Guardian and Observer, which people can take part in as well, because they can influence what we choose in our greatest films.
Just go on to guardian.co.uk/film, and there's lots of stuff there, and there will also be a sort of interactive version of this list on the website, which they spent a long time building, should look pretty good.
Andrew Pulver, thank you very much indeed. Despite its virtually constant presence in the news media, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict has, somewhat ironically, also given rise to a golden era of films dealing with the horrors of war and the terrors of prejudice. It's in this climate that director Julia Basha and producer Ronit Avni have sought out what might be termed alternative stories about the conflict. 2006's Encounter Point revealed how Israelis and Palestinians came together to share their grief on losing family members to violence and to show how they could help each other heal. And the optimistic focus continues this week with the release of Budrus, a humanitarian story documenting one small village's peaceful resistance to the Israeli government's monstrous security wall. To tell me more about the making of Budrus, I'm delighted to be joined on the line from Washington by producer Ronit Avni. Welcome to Film Weekly, Ronit.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's my absolute pleasure. I was watching Budrus. I didn't know what it was about, what I was going to get into, and this documentary unfurled before me. It's intense. It's passionate. It made me uncomfortable. It was optimistic. It uplifted me at certain points. Making it, you must have been through all of those things and much more as well. Can you tell me how long it took to piece this kind of jigsaw together?
Absolutely. This has been a 3-year process of exactly relentless investigative work to track down the footage and the pieces to be able to tell this story.
What was the story that you got that was the impetus for making the project? Did you knew about Budrus defending itself peacefully against the wall, and then you thought, well, I've got to work at how this happened?
We were on tour 4 years ago with our previous film, Encounter Point, and we brought the film to about 200 cities around the world. And a constant question that was asked, particularly in the West and also in Israeli publics, was the question of where is the Palestinian nonviolence movement? And the follow-up statement often went something like, if Palestinians adopted nonviolence, there would be peace. And we knew that the situation was a lot more complicated than that, and we also knew that there were villages like Budrus that were struggling on the ground nonviolently, and that was really the motivation for us to take a deeper look at this issue. Most people don't know that there are thousands of Palestinians and hundreds of Israelis joining them in unarmed struggles in the West Bank today. And Budrus was a particularly powerful story because it united all of the political factions, it brought women to the front lines, and they actually were able to achieve results through this nonviolent movement.
You sort of have your star in this rather saintly individual, this Fatah member, Ayel Marad, who is just sort of, he exudes a sort of movie star charisma, but I don't know if you can exude calmness, but he sort of does, and he does it rather brilliantly, and he's your star, isn't he? He's your focal point.
He is definitely the focal point. I think he was the one that was able to unite all of the factions. He invited Israelis into his home and into his community and internationals, and really was thinking about the strategy day in, day out, about how they were going to save the village and their lands and trees without using any kind of force.
I was watching thinking, because I knew at in the final credits that you were the filmmaker, you're a producer, you're Jewish, I assume. How do you feel about making a film that shows the Israeli army in such a, I suppose, negative light? If I'm honest, they do come across as bullies, but not their fault, but they do come across, you know, as kind of the enemy here.
You know, it's interesting. Truly different audiences have walked away with different impressions of the army. Some people feel very connected to Yasmin, who's the border policewoman at the end of the film. And as I mentioned, some people really did feel that the army showed more restraint than in a lot of other places. I mean, it wasn't Tiananmen Square in terms of the final outcome. It didn't get to that level. At the same time, yes, I am an Israeli citizen, and I do believe it's important for us to look at what happens when a nonviolent movement emerges. In the Israeli public, I think there's often an assumption that if nonviolence was adopted, that the army would welcome it and try to foster and encourage it. And clearly in Budrus, that wasn't the case. And so I think it's critical for us to look at it and find out why. You know, what is the army doing, and is that in the best interest of the people involved?
I do mention that there's a sort of difference in how things are received in the world, and I think Israel is the key place for this in cinema, because a New York Jewish audience and an audience in the Abu Dhabi Film Festival, an audience here in London, and then an audience at the Jerusalem Film Festival will bring different things to this film. I'm delighted to say that your film has played in all of those places, which has sort of surprised me. I'd have thought that each one of them would be very wary of it, but the reactions have been extraordinary.
It's been amazing. We opened at the Dubai International Film Festival, and as you mentioned, you know, we've been to New York and London and Rio and Berlin and Jerusalem and Ramallah. In Jerusalem, the film was sold out. We got great press coverage in Israel. In Ramallah, it was sold out. We've gotten terrific coverage in the Arabic satellite media and beyond. We are constantly trying to engage multiple and unlikely audiences. I think people appreciate learning something that they hadn't known before, hearing a story that they weren't exposed to.
It's a brave path that you're treading, but one that you know no sensible person could argue with. Really, it's a path of peace and optimism. I expect, and that's probably the way that that cinema should be dealing with a conflict like this. Congratulations for treading it so carefully, Ronit Dhavni, and congratulations on your film Budras. Thank you so much for joining us on Film Weekly.
Thank you so much for having me.
Budras, the documentary, is on limited release here in the UK from Friday the 24th of September. To find out where it's screening and to get more information on the movement that it's inspired, go to their website justvision.org/Budras. And that's all for Film Weekly this week. The music featured on the show is from the soundtrack to The Town. The score is by Harry Gregson-Williams of Shrek fame, but there's lots more Bostonian musicians on there too. You might remember a couple of weeks ago we did run a competition to give away two signed copies of the double album Soul Boy soundtrack. That's the Northern Soul film that's taken the Northern cinemas by storm, still doing huge business in Wigan and on Tyneside, starring Martin Compston, Nicola Burley and the lovely Felicity Jones. We asked you what symbol taken from the Black Power movement had been used by fans of Northern Soul, and the answer, of course, is the Black Power clenched fist. We had loads of entries on our Facebook site. Out of the hat came Adrienne Bamberger from Surrey. She's a winner. Thank you, Adrienne, for all your compliments. We do aim to please. And Jamie Sherry from Leicester, who's written back to us on finding out about winning. This is the first thing I've won since 1983, when I won a Turkish Delight at Woodcraft Folk Camp. Do join us on Facebook, Film Weekly fans, that's us. From time to time, we give away preview tickets and all sorts of secret stuff on there. This week, we gave away preview tickets to the animated Cuban feature, Chico and Rita. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and from Film Weekly producer, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye, and we'll see you next week.